Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll speak with Robert Ganji. He's the director of the Police Reform Organizing Project, or PROP, about a new report that the group issued on some old problems at the NYPD and indeed at police departments around the country. PROP's report looked at New York, but I got two of these this week. The ACLU also put out an extensive report on racially discriminatory policing in Minnesota. So again, this is a national issue. We're going to look at it in how it's playing out in New York. Then we'll be joined by Heather Digby Parton to discuss the 2016 elections and the Democratic and Republican primaries. We've got a pretty big show, so we're going to forego my usual snarky introduction and just jump right in. We'll take a quick break and be right back with Robert Ganji. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Robert Ganji. Robert is the director and the founder of the Police Reform Organizing Project, or PROP, which advocates for criminal justice reforms in New York. Robert, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Pleased to be on the air with you.
PROP released a report this week, or last week, titled, "That's How They Get You, New Yorkers' Encounters with Broken Windows Policing." It details well over 100 case studies of city residents' interactions with New York's finest, as they call themselves, and it is a sadly familiar story. Robert, we know about the statistics. We know that poor people and people of color are given a disproportionate number of citations and arrests for low-level infractions. This report puts some meat on those statistics with real-life stories about New Yorkers. And it seems that many of them are becoming more afraid of the police than they are of the bad guys. What were some of the common threads you saw throughout these vignettes?
I think the most significant common thread is the one that's getting more and more attention lately, which is how blatantly racist these practices are. The vignettes that we put in the report were meant to be, and hopefully succeeded to be, emblematic of policy and practice as carried out under the rubric of quota-driven broken windows policing in New York City. And the 85 to 95% of the tickets given out and the arrests being made under broken windows policing are of people of color, mainly poor people of color. So that is the thread that runs out through all these stories. Also, what comes across is how not only discriminatory, but just how unjust these sanctions are that are applied to low-income people of color. How, in some very real way, often they just don't make any sense. When, like, the cops arrest people for putting their foot up on a subway seat when there's hardly nobody else in the on the train. When cops arrest people for jaywalking, for what they call unlawful solicitation, which is when you ask somebody to use your Metro card to swipe them into the subway, even if you're willing to swipe them in, that's considered a violation of the law, and the cops can and do arrest you. And in every case we've seen of unlawful solicitation, the person arrested was a black or brown person. So they're discriminatory. They're always for minor infractions, the kind of activities that have been virtually decriminalized in white communities. And sometimes they reflect almost a theater of the absurd as it's carried out by policing, because it's almost unbelievable to people that cops spend their time and the city's money arresting people for these kinds of activities. In fact, when I speak to my friends about these kind of things, at least initially when I spoke to them about it, and most of my friends are like me, white, middle class, or even upper middle class, they didn't believe me until I just said repeatedly, no, these things happen. We know they happen. We're in the courtrooms when they're being prosecuted. We talked to the lawyers who handle the cases, and then people began to believe me.
And so, you know, we talk about broken windows, which is, you know, the idea that you prosecute low-level crimes, but some of these stories are just ridiculous. They don't seem like they're even infractions in the first place. How do you get arrested for trespassing, standing in a building where you live?
Yes, right, right. One of the first stories that I heard when I started doing the work at Prop was at a public forum that was sponsored by the New York Urban League. And there was a teenage black boy on the panel, and he said in this way that reflected, you know, it was like a head-scratching tone, I've been arrested twice, once given a ticket and once arrested. I'm standing in the lobby of the building where I live, and I'm charged with trespass. Right.
Now, how does that even work? I mean, how can you be arrested for trespassing in your own building?
Well, the one of the things is that becomes clear when you take a look at police practices in New York City is that cops will misrepresent reality. They make things up. They lie, however you want to characterize it. And it's our view and the view of many other people that the only explanation for that kind of behavior by cops is the quota system, that they're under pressure to make their numbers every month, a certain number of arrests, a certain number of tickets, in order to get a good job evaluation, in order to prove that they are quote-unquote productive. So that, and there were a couple of stories that we include in the report where the cops have misgivings about what they're doing, clearly, and they apologize to the people that they're either giving a ticket to or arresting, where they'll say, one cop said to a guy that he gave a ticket to for walking between two subway cars and when the train was stopped, he said, I'm sorry about this, but it's the 26th of the month and I have to make my number. And there are other cases where cops are apologetic, where they're assuring people that the case will be thrown out, you know, when they appear before a judge. And one of the things that's just true about how the quota system operates, and one of the reasons why it's such bad practice, is the cop will get credit for the stop, for the arrest, for the summons, even if the charges get thrown out, either the prosecutor declines to prosecute or the judge dismisses the case. Cop still gets credit. So there's no pressure on the cop to make quality arrests.
Now, police claim that they don't have a formal quota system.
Right, and George Bush said that the United States didn't torture, and Bill Clinton said that he didn't have sex with that woman. They have to claim that they don't have a quota system because quotas are illegal. And in fact, the quotas are not written. It's just understood, and sometimes stated very clearly at the local precinct level what cops have to do to demonstrate that they're being productive. The other problem with quotas is cops only get credit for punitive interactions. one cop, one of the few cops who's on the force who was willing to talk to us, said to me, and who spoke out against the quota, said to me, if I break up a fight between two boys and send them home, I don't get any credit. If I happen to help deliver a baby in an emergency, I don't get credit for that. But I'll get high marks if I give out a seatbelt ticket or make a stop. And the reason why that quote is a quote that we reflect upon a lot and we use in our literature is because we hope it's instructive, that it turns on its head the idea of good policing that most people have.
Ultimately, this gets down to incentives, the incentives that police officers face. Robert, for those who don't follow this issue, what is CompStat?
Well, CompStat was a system put in place in the mid-90s by the NYPD that determines through computer analysis and the other processing of statistics where crimes are prevalent, and then allocates police resources to those areas. CompStat, in and of itself, is, we think, a good practice. CompStat does not have to go hand in hand with quotas or with broken windows. In fact, Jack Maple, who is in the law enforcement world practically a legendary character, he's been dead now for a number of years, but he was the godfather of CompStat. And he was very cynical about broken windows policing. He has a famous quote where he said, you know, murders and rapists don't decide to leave town because there's no more graffiti on the subway. So CompStat that focuses resources on where crimes are prevalent, we support that kind of tactic. That tactic makes sense, and that tactic can lead to a reduction in crime. Broken windows is not so strategic, not so discriminating. It's discriminatory. But broken windows, everybody in a particular community, communities of color, will be seen as a target, partly because of the quota system, partly because of the very philosophy of broken windows. So if somebody spits on the sidewalk, if somebody's carrying an open alcohol container, even if they're not being loud or disruptive, that person becomes a target for a police arrest or ticket.
Well, my understanding is that when you take CompStat and you combine it with the broken windows philosophy of policing, what you're doing is you're taking these statistics and not only using them to determine where you're going to put police officers, but these statistics are used to determine police officers' career advancement, their career path, whether they get raises and promotions, et cetera, et cetera. How does that play into this story?
Well, it's the way CompStat was implemented. In other words, the strategy of focusing your police resources on high crime areas makes sense, and we support that. But part of what was included in the CompStat program in New York City, and it's still in practice, is there would be regular meetings of precinct captains. I think they're monthly meetings, but I'm not sure. And each precinct captain would have to report on his or her crime numbers, the incidence of crime in his or her community. And they quickly learned that they had to report that crime was going down in their precinct area, or they would get blasted by the superior officers in the police department. So what that pressure did that was placed on the precinct captains is, in our view, first of all, led some people just to fix the numbers. So there was so much pressure on them to report a reduction in crime and high levels of activity. Activity meaning, again, is a euphemism for arrests and summonses, that they would make numbers up, or they would put enormous pressure on the officers who worked in their precinct to give out tickets and make arrests. There are quotes on tape of superior officers in local precincts saying things like, you know, if they're standing on the corner, arrest them. If they're wearing bandanas, arrest them. We'll figure out a charge later.
That was detailed in that great book, The NYPD Files.
Right.
And really what we're talking about is taking away police officers' discretion. You know, sometimes it is the wise thing to let small offenses go, and a lot of cops feel like they have this pressure to not do so. You mentioned that a lot of police officers are actually uncomfortable with this situation.
Well, we think most police officers, most people do not become police officers so they can arrest a young person walking a dog for being in the park after dark. And that's the kind of practice that they are pressured to engage in when they become an officer for the NYPD. It's also important to state, so that we keep in touch with reality in terms of this issue, is policing in New York City, and my guess is across the country, has always been marked by high level of discriminatory activity. The NYPD has always treated people of color more disrespectfully and more abusively in our city. We found newspaper articles from the mid-30s that could be describing the kind of discriminatory and abusive incidents that go on today. And we know enough again about the history of the department that those kind of activities go back even further than the 1930s. So what's happening now, for the first time in certainly the city's history and maybe in the country's history, is these abusive practices are being exposed in dramatic ways to the larger public. That exposure and that press coverage has obviously been triggered by these high-profile killings by police officers of unarmed black men, and then the fact that the police officers don't get indicted, that there's no consequences to their actions. But what underlies that are the day-to-day discriminatory and abusive practices carried out by the police department, implemented by the rest of the criminal justice system, prosecutors, the courts, do not stand up and expose the nature of these practices as being sometimes just ridiculous, but certainly being racially discriminatory. And there is a compelling moral issue that's being raised by the exposure of these practices to the public. And it's become, and it makes us hopeful as advocates for reform, it's become the leading social and racial justice issue of the day. And we will keep pressing the issue until there's significant change. So there's a whole reorientation of policing's police philosophies and police purpose in New York City and across the country.
Now, you talked about how police officers get credit for making an arrest, even if it's a bad arrest, even if it's thrown out of court and doesn't get charged. But I want to ask you about the other side of that, because it seems to me that these prosecutions for low-level offenses have real and lasting effects for the people who are caught up in the justice system. So you're picked up for, you know, trespassing in your own building. How does that impact you later on? Do you get caught into this kind of snowball effect where once you're in the criminal justice system, you're in the criminal justice system?
Well, an aspect, a demonic aspect of these practices is the criminalizing of just a whole group of people. Because, again, it's people of color, mainly men, but includes women also, mainly men. They get ticketed and arrested often for low-level infractions that they build up a criminal record. Like, for example, when the cops went to arrest Eric Garner, the arrest that resulted in his death, that would have been the ninth time they arrested him for selling these cigarettes. And in fact, at the beginning of the video, when he holds up his hands and says, "This stops today," you know, before they jump him and in effect kill him, he was talking about broken windows policing and its application. I mean, I doubt if that's the way he thought of it. And so one terrible consequence, is the criminalization of a whole group of people. The emotional trauma it creates for a lot of the people who have these experiences, the fear and distrust and antagonism toward police officers and toward the whole law enforcement system. There are specific ill effects, loss of jobs, loss of job opportunity, loss of opportunity for scholarships, in some cases even deportation, in some cases the loss of parental custody. These practices have serious, serious consequences for the people they're inflicted upon. And we think they also create serious problems for at least some police officers. Their misgivings, their guilt. We know that some police officers, they will, at least we have not seen many of them willing to speak for attribution, but they hate their jobs because in order for them to succeed within the department, these are the activities that they have to engage in. And again, we know at least some of them stick it out because they want to put in their 20 years and get the pension. But it creates enormous stress and tension for them.
And we know that police officers who do oppose these policies face a lot of problems, career problems, ostracization on the job. There was the case detailed in the NYPD tapes of a police officer who was actually put in a mental institution for six right. days for standing up against this stuff. Let me ask you this. We have a mayor who ran in part on these issues. He was against stop and frisk.
Mm-hmm.
His son is a person of color. He says he worries about his interactions with the police officers. This is obviously Mayor Bill de Blasio. There's been a lot of tension between the department and de Blasio, the turning your back thing.
Mm-hmm.
So have things improved under de Blasio?
Not really. There has been a significant decline in the use of stops, which is a good thing. There have been a drop in the issuing of summonses, and it appears, although I'm not sure yet, a drop in misdemeanor arrests. But we, on a day-to-day basis, in our conversations with people from communities of color, when we go into the courtrooms, we go into the arraignment parts, and we see who's being arrested and what they're being charged with, we don't see any difference, and the people don't experience any difference. So, for example, we were in Manhattan arraignment part yesterday, and 30 out of 31 cases were people of color, were African-American or Latino people. And the one white person who had been arrested was a man, middle-aged man, who was wrestling with addiction issues and had fallen off the wagon. So the blatant racial bias continues. The arrest and harassment of people, mainly people of color, for low-level infractions continues. And it is, I'm going to make this point sharply. There's an argument about whether broken windows is effective. One of the common responses that I encounter is, well, doesn't broken windows work? Isn't broken windows what turned the city around in the mid-90s when Giuliani became mayor and Bratton first became police commissioner? And we have two responses to that. One is, and I think the most important one, and it's hard for some people to hear, this is a deeply immoral practice. This is a blatantly racist practice. So even if you can make some claim that it is effective, whatever you mean by that, it is still unacceptable. And I use the example, if my son is cursing at the dinner table and I can't get him to stop by any parental strategy I use, and then I beat the hell out of him and I break his arm, he'll stop. But that what I would have done is still very wrong, and will have created serious problems in the future, including the fact that my son would never trust or respect me again, really. He would only fear me. So these practices, again, are deeply immoral. One of the things that's hard for people, I think, to fully accept is that, and because it goes on right under our noses, and also the fact that in one form or fashion, although broken windows gives it a kind of veneer and institutionalization of the practice. In one form or fashion, these practices have been going on for decades, and we've tolerated them. And also, we certainly, and lots of other people, don't particularly believe that broken windows is effective. That there's a whole lot of reasons why crime dropped in New York City, having nothing to do with police tactics. And crime dropped everywhere in the country and actually in big cities all across the world, cities that did not practice broken windows.
Now, Robert, before I let you go, and I've gone on longer than my time, so I want to thank you for that. We talk about these things. We can talk about police policies from administration to administration, from one era to the other. It seems clear that this is ultimately the result of a deeply ingrained police culture.
Right.
So I guess my question is, how would you go about, how would we as citizens of New York go about overcoming that that cultural challenge?
Well, it's the 64,000, or I guess with inflation, maybe it's a little more expensive question, right? That's the challenge for us advocates. Our view is we have to keep attacking the issue politically and putting out reports like That's How They Get You, which includes all the vignettes of the bad consequences to real people's lives of broken windows. And we have to keep the pressure on de Blasio, basically, and the city council leadership in New York City. And we encourage people all over America, in other large cities where there is the beginnings of a police reform movement, to keep organizing, keep putting out literature, keep speaking to people, keep challenging political leadership to discontinue these racist, immoral, and ineffective practices. So that's the only way change will happen. And we point to, people ask me, which is understandable, that they would, well, we know what you're against, what are you for? And sometimes my answers are a little bit tongue-in-cheek, like I'll say, you watch those cop shows on television? Well, that's what we want police to do. We want police to, you ever see a cop show on television where police are arresting somebody who has a foot up on a subway seat because of the quota system? What you see police doing is investigating serious crimes and taking smart and brave steps to arrest people who are doing really bad, destructive things. There's only small percentage of police officers in New York City for whom that is their focus. And the other thing we point to is the work stoppage that NYPD officers engaged in over a three-week period at the end of December and early January. Arrests declined by 66%, summonses declined by 90%, and the crime, according to the NYPD's own numbers, declined significantly during that period. And there were no reports of police officers not intervening in the commission of serious crimes. We think that whole experience represented an emperor has no clothes moment for broken windows police, because police officers in effect abandoned broken windows and the crime went down. And there was an article in a newspaper or a magazine quoted a young black man expressing in a clearly the tones of great relief. So this is what it feels like to be a white person in New York City, because she wasn't dealing with police harassment on a regular basis.
Robert Ganji, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, again, thanks for having me, and let's stay in touch.
Folks, the report is titled That's How They Get You, New Yorkers' Encounters with Broken Windows Policing, and you can read it at, ready for it, policereformorganizingproject.org. That's all one word, policereformorganizingproject.org. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Heather Digby Parton. Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours. Je ne t'aime plus.
Parfois j'aimerais mourir tellement j'ai voulu croire. Parfois j'aimerais mourir pour ne plus rien avoir. Parfois j'aimerais mourir pour plus jamais te voir. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours. Parfois j'aimerais mourir tellement y a plus d'espoir. Parfois j'aimerais mourir pour plus jamais te revoir. Parfois j'aimerais mourir pour ne plus rien savoir. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I am always happy to have Heather Parton, better known as Digby, on the show. You can read her stuff at her blog, Hullabaloo, or at Salon, where she's a columnist. Hi, Heather. How's it going?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm doing well. It's a beautiful day here on the East Coast.
Nice.
Heather, let's talk a little bit about 2016. Martin O'Malley announced this week the former Maryland governor is virtually unknown in national politics. He is trying to run to Clinton's left, as is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Does O'Malley have a place in this race? Because it seems to me that Sanders already has a kind of a populist following. And also, it doesn't look like Clinton is leaving a lot of room to her left for a challenge.
Well, I'd agree with everything you just said. I think anybody's got a place in the race. I mean, obviously, I think the more the merrier. I think primaries are good, and I think that it's fine for O'Malley or anybody else to get into the race and present himself and go around the country and do their thing. I mean, I don't have any problem with that. I am always a little bit surprised when people are so hostile to the idea of, you know, elections, and particularly primaries, which I think are the one time when people really get a chance to, you know, within the party, within, or even if you're not a Democrat or a Republican, but you're just, you know, someone who wants to be involved in the process of actually choosing candidates, which I think is, you know, kind of inherent to democracy. It seems to me that primaries are a good thing. And so I'm happy to see him in there. So far, Clinton has not left a lot of room to her left. She seems to have gotten the message that her coalition is looking to her to move left from where Democrats have been over the last 20 years. She seems to have sort of, you know, gawked that things have changed since, you know, perhaps she 2006, 2007, when she was running the last time and kind of setting up her campaign. If you read her book, which I just did recently, you know, this is, she's been signaling this pretty loud and clear that she's going to be left of where she was, and I think where people have expected her to be in this race. So we'll see what happens. And I think Bernie and O'Malley, if both of them are pushing even further, great. Good news for the good guys, you know.
Yeah. Well, O'Malley was the mayor of Baltimore, and he was a big proponent of broken windows, zero tolerance policing. Mm-hmm. We talked about that in our first segment. How does that play at a time when police reform has become such a central issue, especially on the left?
I think it's a killer for him, to be perfectly honest. I just don't think his timing could be worse. You know, his reputation, I mean, what else is he known for? Because I don't actually, like most people, I think, that don't live in Baltimore, don't live in Maryland, and maybe even plenty of people who do, I don't really know this guy other than, you know, I've seen him as Mayor Carchetti in The Wire. And that's about, you know, my only reference, which I think is true for, you know, a fair number of people. And that's not really fair. That's a fictional depiction of a politician. So this broken windows thing and the policing is the one. You know, there are two things I actually knew of Martin O'Malley before now, and I'll be interested to see more. But this is what I come into it knowing. He's not a national figure. But there are two things he's known for. One is that really harsh policing policy that he instituted. And the other is the total, you know, cock-up of the Obamacare rollout in Maryland. I actually have a friend who worked on that, who was employed by the state, and said it was the worst bureaucratic nightmare ever. And it was one of the worst rollouts in the country. So whatever claim to fame he has of being a good manager, I think that may have a little problem, present some problems for him as well. So, you know, he's got a lot of work to do if he wants to present himself as somebody who's bringing something to the table that the other two candidates, Sanders and Clinton, aren't bringing. So
he was a fairly progressive governor. He abolished the death penalty. Mm-hmm. He pushed for a minimum wage increase, and he was way ahead of everybody on gay marriage. But the problem is that the other candidates in the Democratic Party, it seems, have all moved, you know, to those positions as well. Again, when I said, is there a place in this race, I didn't mean, you know, is it wrong for him to run, but rather, is there a niche that he fills?
Right.
And I just don't see it. And then when you start out with the name recognition that he has, it looks like an uphill battle for him. Now, Josh Marshall pointed out this week that the Democratic National Committee is sending out a bunch of emails praising Bernie Sanders as this great truth teller. Marshall thinks the Democratic establishment is happy to have Sanders running to Clinton's left, maybe to make it easier for her to pivot for the general election, and maybe she'll adopt some of his positions. Debt-free college seems to be gaining traction within the party in general. What do you make of all this? One thing that I think is obvious is that Marshall points out that if the party had sent out, you know, a bunch of emails touting Obama during the 2008 nomination process, it would have looked entirely different.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, I don't know. I saw that piece too, and I was kind of confused by it. I suspect it's just what you said. You know, if you look at the political establishment and what they would normally do is, you know, they're going to be very concerned that Hillary is placing herself too far to the left, and that's going to destroy her chances to win the general election because she will be seen as too liberal. And that would be the classic concern of the political establishment. You know, then again, you know, I'm assuming that the political establishment now, it consists of many members of the Obama administration and people who have, you know, come up through these years that Obama's been in. And the lessons those people are taking, at least if you believe someone like Dan Pfeiffer, who mentioned in his exit interview that he did with Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, that they had learned a different lesson, that, you know, they do better when they don't do this constant, you know, coddling of the right or moving to the center or pivoting or whatever, that they found that they didn't have as much success when they did that as when they were just sort of unabashedly progressive. Now, granted, he was talking about legislation and working, you know, within the government on specific issues. But I think the lesson, I would assume and did assume from that they had taken a lesson from that, which was that they have a real coalition of, you know, backers, of followers out there in the country, that these ideas are actually worth trying to implement and that people are supportive of that and that they actually do better when they're sort of honestly approaching these things from, you know, the standpoint of, you know, their own principle and philosophy. You know, this thing with, you know, trying to promote Bernie so that Hillary doesn't look so liberal sounds like real old-fashioned stuff. And I'm not saying that isn't what happened. I can't think of another explanation for it, to be honest. But if it is what they're doing, then the political establishment, the Democratic Party, is sadly kind of
stuck in the 90s.
I think behind the times. Yeah. And it's interesting because there was an article in the Democratic Strategist last week, which also talked about the media and how, you know, they're whining and kvetching about how Hillary isn't taking questions and blah, blah, blah. And they're getting very petulant about it, being very upset. And, you know, this article in Democratic Strategist, which is kind of a centrist sort of, you know, site. I've never thought of them as being flaming liberals by any means. I think it is sort of DLC-ish kind of center, that sort of thing. They were saying that, you know, Hillary is completely right to ignore the press. It's important that the press be challenged on this stuff, that they are, you know, that they have a kind of an inherent hostility towards liberalism. And it was a very interesting piece coming from a group that I wouldn't expect that to be, granted on a different subject than what we're talking about in terms of campaign strategy. But nonetheless, there seems to me to have been a kind of, you know, a late awareness that's overtaken members of the Democratic establishment that the old way of doing things is no longer relevant, and they need to sort of accept, you know, we're in a polarized situation. There's two competing political factions in the country, and the way that they will win is not by trying to co-opt that any members of that other faction, but by inspiring their own group and being, you know, much more aggressive about doing that. So, you know, I don't know. I certainly hope they've learned their lesson. I mean, this is something people like you and I have been talking about for many years.
But, yes, absolutely. You know. Well, I mean, Hillary is clearly running a populist campaign against inequality and money in politics. She has a challenge in that she hobnobs with the top 1% of the top 1%. I think the larger question for progressives is, you know, how to keep her feet to the fire should she win. Speaking of which, according to the Cook Political Report, Hillary Clinton, if she wins, will likely become the first Democratic president in history to never govern with a House majority. It's not a certain thing, of course, but it reflects the GOP's dominance in House races, the natural migration patterns that create wasted Democratic votes in very densely populated districts, and also gerrymandering, because the GOP has control of a lot of state houses. Is there any reason for optimism in a Clinton presidency if that should come to pass? I mean, it'd be great to have a woman president, but it just seems like we'd still face, you know, the situation where we have one party that is anti-governing, that is objectively opposed to governance, and in a position to throw a monkey wrench into the works.
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't think there's any, I mean, you never know. I mean, something could, you know, something dramatic could change. There could be some big event that makes everything, you know, topples this particular paradigm that we're living in at the moment. But that, what you just described seems like what it's going to be. So basically what you're looking for in a president are a couple of things, you know, using the power of the presidency in what, you know, whatever power they have, and that includes, you know, naming members to the, you know, to the judiciary, although, you know, the Senate obviously has something to do with that. But there's a possibility that the Democrats may actually take back the Senate, so maybe there's some hope there. You know, there's the administrative part of it where they're, you know, they run the executive branch and all the agencies, and Obama's showing some real gumption in that regard in his lame duck period here, and just holding off the other side. I mean, I am not particularly optimistic about, you know, any great change. I'm just hopeful at this point that someone, whether it's Hillary or, you know, Sanders, O'Malley, whoever, will be there to try and hold off, you know, the any attempts to make it worse. And, you know, we're all looking at a Republican Party that is in the throes of, and you know, they have lost their center. They have lost it. It's gone. And this is a party that is in real, I mean, I would say they're in crisis. And I don't know that you want a party in crisis, you know, in power, certainly not in the White House. There's some very, very ugly stuff being said on the campaign trail already on foreign policy. It's just scarier than hell. I mean, maybe it's all just bellicose pandering, but it's
frightening.
It's frightening, and it's worrying. Because the world is unstable. There's a lot of stuff going on, and, you know, you could see some things getting really out of hand with these people. And not that I had any idea. I mean, if there's one area that I would love, that I'm with the press on with Hillary Clinton, is what her views are on foreign policy, which is one area where the president has tremendous power. And she's very, you know, obscure in this area as far as her views are at the moment. I really don't know what she thinks. And it's one of her selling points, having been Secretary of State. And, you know, that is of concern, too. I mean, I would really hope that we have a president who is at least as, say, cautious as Obama. I mean, there are many areas that I disagree with him, but there have been some where he has shown a lot of fortitude in fighting back the foreign policy and national security establishment on some stuff that they wanted to do. And I would hope that she would have that same sense of caution about that stuff. But I don't know. I honestly don't have a clue where she is on that.
I'm actually quite concerned about this, in that I worry that as the first woman commander in chief, she will feel pressure from within her group of advisors, and also external pressure from the media, to be more hawkish than perhaps she would be inclined to be otherwise if she were a male.
All Democrats feel that anyway, right? I mean,
yes,
they come into office
and
all
Democrats have that fear of being branded soft on this or soft on that. And just given gender stereotyping, I mm-hmm. worry that she's going to go out of her way to fight back against that. Now, when you talked about the executive power, there was a very interesting article. I don't know if you saw this week in USA Today. It was by Gregory Court. And he wrote about how Obama has been turning to city halls to try to enact his legislative priorities on a local level in a way that's never been done. So in the past, there's certainly been White Houses that reached out to state houses, city halls, but according to Court, the Obama White House, quote, appears to be the first to aggressively use those same channels to encourage them to adopt Obama's policies. And he notes that since the 2013 address, when Obama called for an increase in the minimum wage, 17 states and 6 major cities have done so. So they're working behind the scenes to try to move their agenda in ways that are untraditional, which I think is it was an interesting piece. Let's go.
I didn't see that, but that's really interesting if they're doing that.
It was really fascinating. I'll email you the piece. It's really worth reading. Yeah,
wow.
It's an interesting piece. Now, on the other side, we had a few new entrants into the GOP field. Let me ask you this. Why would George Pataki run for the GOP nomination? The guy believes in climate change. He's pro-choice. He championed new gun safety laws. And you can understand like a Ted Cruz running to bolster his reputation as the party's true conservative and to raise money. You can see a guy like Rick Santorum running in an effort to remain relevant 8 years after losing his Senate seat. But Pataki, he's not selling a book. He isn't trying to lead a faction within the Republican. What's in it for him to get annihilated in the primaries?
I could not tell you. I do not. This is now they're talking about, you know, it's like 19 kids and counting, right? I mean, they're thinking there's going to be 19 or 20 candidates running around, and Pataki being one of the more bizarre ones. I honestly don't think I can't imagine what constituency he thinks he has.
Right.
Maybe it's just his last gasp at, you know, trying to, I don't know what. I mean, you know, governor of New York, good. That's a legacy that one should be proud of. And I don't know why he thinks that it's worth it. But apparently, I mean, you have to assume if you're going to do this, there are some people that are doing this for other reasons. I mean, I have to assume that someone like Carly Fiorina, I don't think she believes she's going to be president. She's staking out a position for herself within the Republican Party. And she's also kind of playing the role of hatchet woman against Hillary Clinton. She can say things, I think, that the men perhaps are more reluctant to say. And so she's playing that part. But Pataki, I don't know what is wrong. I mean, maybe he thinks there's room for a moderate. I don't know why he'd think that.
Why would he? Look, you got Jeb Bush in as, I mean, if they want a moderate, I don't know that Jeb actually is one, but He certainly plays one in the media, right?
Yeah.
I mean, George Pataki, it's just, he wakes up in the morning and goes, I'm going to run for president in this, like, revanchist party where I have no place whatsoever. And I just, and his rollout video, did you see his rollout video?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what in the world? You know what he reminds me of? And although I actually got the logic of this one, John Huntsman in the last, the last go around in 2012, I think he, and I think, didn't he have some big shot strategist like Mike Murphy or Steve Smith or one of those, you know, kind of modern guys on the Republican side? And I think they made a strategic decision, and it was really wrong one, but you can understand why somebody would have made it, that when Obama won in 2008, that the Republican Party would have to move to the left.
Right.
And Huntsman saw his position there in 2012 as being the guy, and he even joined the Obama administration, which was like, you know, that's heresy. He wrote himself off at that point. You know, you
yes.
couldn't do that. But he didn't know that, and I could see why someone might say, you know what, let's carve out our position as the moderate, the cooperative, the bipartisan guy, and we'll run in 2012 and see what happens. And of course, it blew up on it. He had no chance whatsoever. But you could see that happening in 2012, and you could even see it happening here, except there is absolutely no evidence that the party is in any way ready to moderate. There's none. I mean, it just doesn't exist in the polling. They don't, you know, look at the people they like. You know, I think there's some, you know, a sort of fantasy on the part of some commentators who think that, you know, they're going to find some perfect candidate, who, you know, maybe Jeb or Scott Walker, who, you know, has all the cred on the right, and then the right will let him, you know, move to the center for the general because
this
they're getting practical and they want to win. It is
yeah.
a fantasy.
It's an absolute
It's not
going to
happen.
Yeah.
You know, they're not there yet. And maybe, you know, I can't tell the future. I don't know where they're going to go. I mean, it seems logical. They can't keep moving to the right and they can't just keep getting more and more extreme. They are going to end up losing something. But, you know, in each of these midterms, they have won big. And they, you know, if they're the dominant party, you know, in any election, if they can get their people out and Democrats don't, they can win big in these congressional elections. And, you know, is that such a bad thing? I mean, the Democrats for years held the Congress and did all kinds of stuff, you know. So
yeah,
they can, you know.
Now, Fox News announced this week that they were going to do the winnowing. They are going to only allow the top 10 candidates in, what is it, the average of the five polls, the five latest polls at the time for the first. Oof, did I do speak English. They're going to allow those who are polling at the top 10 at the time to participate in the first debate. We're obviously not seeing a clown car this time around. It's a clown bus or a clown RV. So this could end up, you know, getting a Trump in and a Ben Carson in, but it could exclude, you know, real politicians like Lindsey Graham. What's your view of this process? Is there a fair alternative?
You know, I don't know. You can't really see debates where there are 20 people on the stage. I mean, that wouldn't be a debate, right? I mean, it would just be a forum. It's kind of a useless thing. So I don't know. I mean, they kind of have a problem. It depends on, you know, you could split them up. You could do two, you know,
two
draw
debates.
Straws and
yeah.
put two debates with different groups of people, which I think would be fine. I mean, I would watch. I love these Republican primaries.
Oh,
debates.
Me too.
Like
they're the best drinking game ever.
Oh, my God. I love them so much. And so I'm really looking forward to this. And the more they have, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Me too.
But obviously, I'm not the person.
Right.
The fact that I enjoy them so much is a problem for the Republican Party.
Yes,
they know
it is.
But, you know, the fact that they have these, you know, these cranks who poll so strongly by comparison. I mean, there's, you know, they came out with one of the big polls last week, I can't remember which one, which showed that there's no front runner. They're all polling, you know, there's kind of a top tier and a bottom tier.
There's
but, you know, there's nobody
tie.
Running.
five
yeah,
more
times.
Yeah,
they've got nobody running away with this. There's no consensus by any means. I mean, this is a real race, which is kind of exciting, you know.
Yeah, it is.
And
it is.
I mean, it's fun to watch. You just don't see that very often. Normally, it's more like the process in the Democratic Party, where it's, you know, it's they're the ones this time to sort of have an anointed candidate. You know, usually the Republicans are the ones who do that.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting to watch that happen. And it's you know, as a political junkie, it's as good as it gets in presidential politics. But, you know, they could very well wind up doing exactly the opposite of what they wanted, because they were afraid after 2012, you know, that was such a fun primary season for people like you and me. We really had a good time, and they don't want that to happen again. You know, we had Michelle Bachmann, and we had Herman Cain, and, you know, and even Rick Santorum was winning all the way to the end. I mean, that guy came in second. That's how, you know, much of a wild you know, race that was, Newt Gingrich and all these people. And that was just at the very beginning of the millionaires, you know, starting to dip their toes in the presidential pool. And what that meant was that any crank, you know, you got this guy Foster Freeze, right?
Yes.
A real crank, but very, very wealthy, put his money on Rick Santorum. He's a
right wing. And he might do it again this time.
He could do it again this time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got, you know, you had Newt Gingrich, had Sheldon Adelson putting $10 million in. I mean, you know, and you know, these millionaires or billionaires, they demand that these candidates, you know, back their issues. They're not giving them the money just because. There's a reason why they are. It's you know, they basically are hiring these people to carry their issues for them. And these guys are all willing to do it. I mean, I'm not saying that they're going against their beliefs and doing it, but, you know, that's basically, it's a very transactional sort of thing. Now that it's become socially acceptable for billionaires to pick a candidate and bankroll them, who knows? I mean,
yes,
this could, you know, Ben Carson could be,
yes,
in the, you know, he could,
absolutely,
they could give him $20 million and that guy could be there all the way to the end. So, you know, this is kind of an interesting, you know, you always wonder when these crazy laws come in and then you see a big social change that goes around it, which is the fact that people aren't afraid anymore to get involved in partisan politics. People with money, they're willing to put their names on it. It doesn't have the kind of dirty connotation that it used to have, you know, so they're willing to get their hands dirty. And, you know, that the talk about unintended consequences, this could have some very serious consequences for people.
That's true.
Particularly on the big money Republican side, where,
yeah,
who knows?
And Politico reported this week that Rand Paul is struggling to raise money because there is no sugar daddy in the, you know, reform NSA and rollback Civil Rights Act segment of the Republican coalition. That was the Quinnipiac poll this week that Ed Kilgore called the poll from hell. It showed five candidates tied with 10% support, and a whole bunch of other soon to be also Rands. So we're looking at by one count that there's over 30 potential Republican candidates, and only 9 weeks to go before that big debate, which means that they're going to have to be, if you have low name recognition, you're going to have to up the crazy to stand out in the very short time that you have to get over that whatever 6% mark that you are going to need to get on Fox News' stage. Heather Digby Parton, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Oh, it was lots of fun. Thanks, Joshua.
Folks, read Heather at Hullabaloo and on Salon, and follow her on Twitter at Digby56. I'd also like to thank Robert Ganji from the Police Reform Organizing Project. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can also write an email griping about this very show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. Of course, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. Have a terrific week. We know.